Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where educators go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top leaders across the globe. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Danny Sunshine Bauer.
In today's show, I connect with Naftali Hoff, the founder of Impactful Coaching and the author of the new book, Becoming the New Boss. Some of the show highlights include how school leaders can motivate their staff, why it's okay to be an introvert, but make your leadership participatory. And Naftali shares a beautiful bottom-up buy-in story of starting PBIS at his school. And I never want to take for granted that you're listening to this show. So thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, and I hope you enjoy it. Today's podcast is brought to you by CSC Consulting Group, whose venture is a social enterprise, and their vision is to catalyze sustainable change in our society, one organization at a time. Learn more at www.cscconsultinggroup.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. I know the owner and founder of School Spirit Vending. He is a personal friend, and he brings hassle-free fundraising to your school. But even better, Matt has written a top 10 school fundraising ideas of 2017. He's given it away completely free. Get it at schoolzonepodcast.com. That's the top 10 school fundraising ideas of 2017 at schoolzonepodcast.com. Well, hey there, better leaders. I am excited to be joined today by Naftali Hoff, an accomplished executive coach, an organizational consultant, and sought-after trainer and lecturer. He completed his doctorate in human and organizational psychology, which analyzes successful individual or organizational change and development, and holds two master degrees in education and educational leadership, respectively. Naftali's practical, action-oriented approach has endeared him to his many clients. His personal experience in the leadership field allows him to understand leaders' needs and craft solutions to help them optimize their performance and success. Naftali, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for having me. It's really a pleasure.
Hey, so before we get too deep into it, you know, I skipped over your credentials and, I know PhDs and I've seen EdDs. I know how to pronounce those. I forgot to ask you, like, I see it. It says PsyD. Is that how you
pronounce it? Yes, that is how you pronounce it.
Okay.
So it's a doctorate in psychology, but it's not clinical psychology. As you mentioned, it's human and organizational psychology. So the focus is not on the individual as much as on how organizations operate, how they function. And my particular interest and particular focus is on the leadership angle and how leaders impact organizations, how they impact change, how they impact growth and development.
Wow.
And in fact, my doctoral research was specifically focused on how it is that school leaders most motivate their teachers to perform and really, you know, provide their very best in their professional practice. So
yeah,
that's my passion, and that's where I'm focused.
Well, can we start there with school leaders and motivating their staff?
Yeah, we certainly can. So without going too technical with the research, basically, I had tried to isolate a variety of different skills, working with the research previously done research by Robert Marzano and his team, as well as some of the work from Charlotte Danielson, to really understand what it was within the various quadrants, if you will, of what school leaders need to be focusing on and where they provide support. What are the areas that teachers ultimately see are those that are most impactful for them? And it's not surprising, you know, ultimately what did emerge from the research is that people most strongly connect with and appreciate the interpersonal elements. In other words, the technical aspects of the job, understanding curriculum, understanding aspects of an effective lesson and providing that feedback, of course that's important. And, you know, that's what distinguishes a school leader from any other leader. On the other hand, what motivates the teachers the most, what gives them the most juice in their practice to motivate them to want to grow, to want to learn more things, to make change, which we all know in the area of education can be awfully difficult, especially for certain teachers who've been in the grind, so to speak, for a long time and have their lessons planned out and have their curriculum, you know, they know it by heart and they kind of like have their routine pretty much down.
Yep.
And they've been doing it for decades. For them to now revisit and make changes and adjust and all of that really requires a lot of personal connection. that really requires getting people to think beyond where they were and what the 21st century learner really needs, and how are we going to ensure that we meet those children's needs specifically where they are. And so you could bring all this intellectual conversation to the table, but to really get people to move, to change, to consider, et cetera, you have to create a framework where you're a learner as well, where you're motivating people to think differently, where you're engaging them in conversation, where you're providing them with real examples. And then when you go into their classroom to do those observations, instead of doing it in a unilateral fashion where this is what I saw, et cetera, and I mean, I'm sure everybody listening to this knows this, but it's really got to be a conversation. And it's got to be a conversation that allows the teacher to really feel that they're valued and respected. And then you have the baseline for all subsequent conversation that eventually may move them in a more positive direction.
I love what you're talking about in terms of the personal connection, and then this last piece with communicating value and respect through the conversation. And I'm curious if you have any tactics, right, for some listeners that this might sound a little foreign or potentially a little scary on how to do it.
Yeah. I'm happy to jump in on that. It's interesting because I think I learned this the hard way. A little bit of background. I had participated in a principal's fellowship program, and we had learned very much in depth, specifically the walkthrough approach of Madeline Hunter, and everything from identifying and stating the objective, the anticipatory set, the whole nine yards. And I brought it back. You know, I'd never really, despite the fact that I had 2 degrees in education, never really had gone through that particular process. And it was an eye-opener for me. I came back to my school and was walking, observing, doing all these various things. But what I would often do is collect my notes, type them up, send it in the program that we had purchased, an online program which kind of held on to everything and also generated PDF reports. And I'd send it out to the teachers, and it would basically be radio silence. You know, no response, no conversation. And I felt that either I wasn't writing them up properly, or the teachers kind of felt like this is not a conversation. This is just the principal going ahead and sharing what he thinks, and that's the end of it. And so that's really, you know, the beginning and the end of that process. So I reconsidered how I did it. I invited the teachers for a conversation. I asked them their opinion about how things went. And then I began to probe, and I would say, I noticed that at this particular time you did this. Tell me more about that. And tell me why it was that when this child spoke out, you chose to respond in this type of way. And so that began a real conversation. And then I would be able to write up the report afterwards and add some very important words that were not possible prior to that. And those words were as per our conversation or as we discussed. And so it was no longer me just saying, this is what I think and that's the end of it. But it's, this is what we discussed together. And these are some ideas that came about as a result. So then when I come back to the teacher with any, you know, question about follow-up or things like that, it's operating from a place of mutual conversation. It's also operating from a place of, you know, hopefully mutual buy-in, or at least that was the idea when we were having the conversation initially. And so if things weren't moving forward, it was a lot easier for me to revisit that in a manner that was not as contentious or perhaps threatening for the teacher.
It's fascinating stuff. And Naftali, I'm curious, what got you even into education at the beginning? What inspired you to pursue a career there?
I don't know the answer to that because, you know, it's interesting. When I was a teenager back in the day, LA, I'm probably dating myself a little bit, but LA Law was one of the fashionable shows on TV. And I envisioned myself as being one of these sweet-talking lawyers who were, you know, doing quite a bit of work in the legal front. Yeah. And then somewhere I went off to study in Israel a few years after high school. And I guess I just caught the bug and decided that I wanted to be able to give. And I felt through a variety of informal opportunities that I had that I was relatively good at it. You know, I'd gotten good feedback. I got a sense that this was something that I could do. And so I pursued a master's in education soon thereafter and got into a classroom and really never looked back. And so a few years into my teaching career, I also began taking on, I guess you would call concurrent administrative positions. One, a supplementary educational program after school that taught religious studies. And then I became an associate principal and eventually became a head of school down in Atlanta and was there for a bit before I decided that I wanted to be able to give in a different type of way. And as I learned about school leadership, and specifically as I interacted with people who were there to help me through a variety of challenges that I was experiencing, I said to myself, you know, wouldn't it be great if I could move into that coaching and consulting space where I could provide feedback, a sounding board, some direction, and some guidance for people who ultimately are the ones leading their schools and creating that impact. So it's a little bit different. I miss those relationships. I certainly miss being with the kids in a more intimate setting, etc. But I felt that this would be a way by which, through my writings, through my talks, through my workshops and things like that, that I would be able to ultimately have a bigger impact and frankly, have a little bit more control over my schedule and, you know, and all of those things.
And has that proved to be true?
Yes, it has.
I'm curious too, where were you in Atlanta? I was in East Cobb.
Oh, okay. Cobb, so Toco Hills. It's a little bit south, I believe, of where you were.
Gotcha.
But it's I think just within the perimeter still.
I'm
a New Yorker and I lived for 12 years in Chicago. So my head sort of thinks in terms of grids and whatnot, which is not the formula for Atlanta. That's for sure not. I never quite figured out the geography, and thank God for GPS. That's all I can say.
Yeah,
you're if not, I would have been in a lot of trouble.
Oh man!
But yeah. It is a beautiful city, and I learned a lot. I really did. And frankly, you know, I try to rely on a lot of those experiences, both positive as well as what at the time at least felt negative, to be able to, you know, to make a difference in the work that I do.
Right. I'm a Chicago guy too, so highly respect and admire the grid.
Yeah.
Just makes sense.
Yeah. And now that they have winning baseball, it's perfect.
How about that? I'm a Sox fan though. So.
Oh, okay. But even they got their time in the sun. So
that's
so,
right.
No problems.
Hey, Naftali, how would you describe your leadership style and how'd you develop it?
It's interesting because I think part of my leadership style evolved in a little bit of a vacuum, in the sense that I'm talking specifically now about my time in Atlanta, because that to me was the opportunity for me to really be, so to speak, king of the hill, you know, CEO of the school, providing that leadership as head of school. And there I had succeeded somebody who was much older than I, but very outgoing, very, you know, high energy, really knew everybody very well. And I think, I can't say for sure, but to me had all of the elements of a type A extrovert. And I happen to be introverted. And it's interesting to me that I found that many, many people in school leadership are in the same type of situation. In fact, when I was still living in Chicago and I was an associate principal, we participated in a program where all of us, you know, did a 360 feedback circle as well as some other pieces. And the overwhelming majority, I wouldn't say 90%, but definitely at least 60%, if not more, identified as introverts. And so I actually had to develop a leadership style that took into consideration, in a way, my own interests, my own needs, you know, door open, door closed, those kinds of things, with a culture and with an organization that had different expectations. And I think that was something that was very hard for me and hard for them to get used to. You know, I was much more technological than my predecessor, but I was also much more private in many ways. And I liked to close the door and I liked to think and I liked to write. And, you know, I couldn't be perhaps as accessible all the time as maybe I needed to be, or maybe some people would have wanted me to be. So those were some of the things that kind of developed. But I think what I became, I don't know if I was necessarily this way the entire time, I try to make my leadership much more participatory. For example, one of the things that I find all principals struggle with is, how do you ensure that whatever professional learning you're doing really sticks within a school? And so oftentimes you'll bring a speaker down to the school in August or early September, depending on when you start, and you'll have your launch and you'll have that professional development shot in the arm, and you're going to focus this year on, I don't know, cooperative learning, whatever it might be. And then, like anything else, things start to fall apart. You know, attention gets shifted elsewhere, and report cards are due, and you have parent-teacher night, and on and on and on. And so how do you keep your focus on those educational goals that you've set? And so part of it has to do with setting goals with individual teachers and working with them, either myself or my administrative team. But part of it had to do with, how can I create opportunities within the time where we know we have to be with each other where I can model and discuss things that are relevant. And so I'll use cooperative learning because that was something that we had been focusing on. We had a lot of frontal teaching going on in our school and we wanted to shift. And so I actually began after the initial professional development presentation and all of this in the early part of the year. We then worked to ensure that every faculty meeting from that point on shifted so that it was not just, here's my list of agenda items and go through it bullet point by bullet point, but how can we wrap ourselves around real conversation? And specifically, how can we focus on issues that have collective appeal, things that are relevant to everybody, and do so in a way where everybody's talking, everybody's engaged, everybody's involved. And so I would model, whether it's through Jigsaw or Think Pair Share or a variety of other cooperative techniques, how do you, you know, I wanted the teachers to see it in action, but I also wanted it to be that the substance, the content of the conversation was relevant and meaningful to them. So that would be an example of trying to shift things to a more participatory fashion. And another example of it is we integrated PBIS within the school during my final year as well, something that I picked up on from that same fellowship. And it was a perfect confluence for me because I had been learning about it, getting excited about it, and it was a personal thing. And at the same time, teachers were coming to me and complaining that they felt that many of the students were starting to demonstrate or were just continuing to demonstrate certain behaviors that they felt were inappropriate and should not be tolerated. And so the teachers had a need. I had some learning. And we just brought the two together. We created a special faculty committee that had administrative and teacher representation. We focused on what would be our core values. We focused on establishing a mission statement, if you will, for the program, identifying everything from, you know, what the mascot would look like to the general messaging and how we would prioritize the whole nine yards. And all of that emerged from conversation with teachers. And we not only did it with that small group because you needed to have the focused conversation, otherwise it doesn't go anywhere. On the other hand, at the pre-year meeting, actually the year before, the end of the year meeting, and then the pre-year, and then into the year school faculty meetings, every single meeting had an element of this PBIS component. And we were getting teachers to vote to share applications. So where do you see respect, for example, in the bathroom or in the classroom or in the shared spaces within the building? And where do you see responsibility? We happen to choose those two as well as two other values. And so the teachers had an opportunity to comment, to discuss. And then after every focus meeting, every small group meeting that we had with that particular committee, after I shared my feedback to the committee, I took the notes and, you know, typed it up and shared it with them. And once I got their approval that everything was in order, I then sent a summary to the entire faculty so that they can feel like they have an idea of what's going on. They could weigh in with comments and considerations, and then we could fine tune accordingly. And that allowed us to really launch that program with greater success. We had kind of like a family feud concept with teachers, you know, where they were on two teams and we had some guy who was like running the game, and we had speakers from the community come in, the local rabbi or others, who would talk to the kids about that respective value. And then we'd have other fun activities with t-shirts and other paraphernalia that helped bring everybody on board. But I don't think, and in retrospect, I maintain this view, that if we would have been sort of top-down presenting administratively, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're implementing it, it would not have had anywhere near the level of buy-in as we had this way. And I needed the teachers. You know, they had to be the ones who were acknowledging the good behaviors and rewarding them or identifying problems or asking me to make modifications. I could never have known that on my own. The only way to be able to do that is if I had the teachers providing that feedback. And their willingness to provide it, I think, was a reflection of the fact that they felt that if they provided it, it would be heard and would be acted upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so important. Again, that's connecting back to that conversation of really respecting and valuing, you know, the other person and what they bring to the table, their viewpoints. And I think you just taught a mini masterclass on organic and bottom-up leadership where you really distributed power, allowed folks to grapple with the ideas, aligned it to mission, vision, values, wove it throughout the year so that it wasn't just, you know, a fad, and people really took ownership, you know, and it sounds like it was a success. But I'm going to go back and listen to that story after this conversation. That was great.
My pleasure.
Awesome. So we were talking about leadership there. Maybe now you can share a story that's not so beautiful, but I love asking guests, you know, what has been your worst leadership mistake and what have you learned from it?
Yeah. So I alluded to some of that before. I think that in that transition period, it happens to be that it was an unusual situation because my predecessor, his wife had a terminal illness and he was retiring anyway, but she got sick and they didn't even finish the year in the school. They wound up going off to Israel and she passed away soon thereafter. So I never really had a chance to bond with him and to learn from him. You know, that was one area that I can't say was necessarily my fault, but I certainly regret not having that opportunity. But otherwise, I think it was really more a matter of trying to create the right balance. So for example, I walked into a situation where as wonderful as my predecessor was, there were a lot of things that he wouldn't or didn't address that the board wanted to see, you know, some change with. And so I understood from all of the interviews, from all the conversations, from all of the various messaging that I had received, that they wanted to see some change, you know, and they wanted to see some change. They had some older teachers who perhaps weren't really performing, that were just, from the perspective of the lay leadership, were just being renewed year over year just because, that type of thing. And so I felt this mandate to move forward with change, and I think the teachers felt that as well. And I think the result of that was a certain uneasiness that was created where the teachers felt threatened. And of course, I try to learn from it and certainly try to adjust, but it was a lot of backtracking at that point. And I feel like in retrospect, if I would have been able to set the proper expectation with the lay leadership, let them know that I need to be able to learn the lay of the land, to be able to understand who I'm dealing with. You know, sometimes you deal with crisis and you don't have that luxury. On the other hand, that creates a great opportunity sometimes because people recognize that we need to change if we're going to survive this dilemma, whatever it might be. On the other hand, in a more normative situation of regular leadership transition, my learning and therefore as a result, my advice is that you try to manage change carefully. You know, you try to create the right type of foundational openness to that change, and to the best degree that you can, get the rank and file to really be the one to ultimately push that change forward. So the PBIS example that I mentioned before, I think was an application of that. But earlier on, I may have just decided that this is the way we should do it. Now, it wasn't necessarily because I had that opinion and I just thought it up on my own and decreed it, so to speak, from my ivory tower. I did listen to people and I did get feedback, but maybe I didn't go far enough and maybe I didn't create enough safety in the conversation that people could be truly honest with what they were thinking. So I think that where you put the relationship first, where you prioritize that all change is necessary, but all change is intended for the betterment of the school and for the betterment of the organization, everybody involved in it, then I think people can approach it with less resistance and less defensiveness and can actually look at it for what it is.
Can you tell me the story, Naftali, of starting Impactful Coaching?
Yeah, so let's put it this way. When I decided that it was time for me to go a little bit on my own, yeah, I'd been in a school environment for a while, and I felt that I was working really hard and making a big impact, but I didn't feel for myself that it was fully sustainable. You know, I felt like I needed, just based off of who I was and the way that I operated, an environment where I could be a little bit more independent and also, like I mentioned before, have a broader impact. So I wanted to be able to bring professional development programming to teachers for sure. I still do that, but also for leaders, you know, school leaders, both academic as well as non-academic leaders, and bring to them deeper insight and understanding of how organizations work, how change is implemented, how you go ahead and delegate things so that you can live a more balanced and comfortable life and you don't burn out, you know, quickly. These kinds of lessons that I felt that I would be able to impart. You know, I'd been doing professional development at that point for organizations, independent schools, et cetera, for about 10 years. So I knew that I could do it. And I knew that it was something that people had received well in the past. And I said to myself, you know what? Oftentimes what happens is people are in the field for many, many years, and then they decide to move into consultancy. They're already well into their 50s, early 60s. And so their window of time in making that impact is significantly reduced. I said, you know, I want to give it a shot in my early 40s and see what I can make out of it. And it actually worked very well for me. You know, thank God I've been canvassing I live now in the New York area. I'm very busy traveling all over, though with New York traffic, that's not always a pleasure. But nonetheless, and I get on a plane, I'm traveling quite a bit, doing a lot of teaching and a lot of coaching and a lot of professional development through that process. So that was really the seed of it. And where I really learned the importance of this type of work was actually in a time when I felt I needed some help. You know, there were some issues, like I mentioned before, in the dynamic with me and the teachers. There were some general concerns about how we were going to move certain things forward. And so we brought in a consultant, and that consultant helped to identify strategic priorities. We went ahead and moved forward with, I think there were six that she put together. We wound up moving forward with three, possibly four, I don't remember now at the moment. And that got everybody sort of wrapped around moving in the same general direction. The board was more participatory because I think they felt they recognized the value that the consultant added to our own internal knowledge. The teachers felt that the agenda was coming from an external place but was also coming from their feedback. And so it created a lot of opportunity that prior to that did not exist. And I really was taken by that. And I felt like if there was any way by which I could similarly go into organizations, into schools, into other types of entities and provide some type of guidance, direction, support that would completely transform those schools and those organizations, then to me, that was worth everything.
Yeah, it was definitely worth the risk. And so I admire that entrepreneurial spirit that you have because you saw a problem, you saw something that you needed. Instead of waiting around to get it, you know, you provided the solution.
Well, I'm certainly trying. It's an ongoing thing, but you know, it's also interesting when you work for yourself and you do this type of work, you start to see more clearly what the solutions could be, and you work hard at trying to meet them. Whereas in a school environment, obviously there's a lot of visioning and a lot of things you're trying to accomplish, but at the same time, a lot of it also tends to be sort of the formalities of the position. A lot of the technical aspects. And that actually didn't speak to me as much. You know, I wasn't so into reviewing all of the report cards or doing these kinds of things. Not because they wasn't important. It was more of the technical grunt work, if you will, you know, associated with the job. And I was much more into the teaching. I was much more into the engaging. I was much more into, you know, creating a vision and moving people along towards something better than where they were. And I felt that I could do that more effectively in this type of work.
Today's podcast is brought to you by CSC Consulting Group, whose current portfolio includes individual schools, nonprofit organizations, small and large districts, and urban school systems. Their home city is in Chicago, but their work can be done anywhere in the nation, and they're actively looking for clients around the world. Find out more at www.cscconsultinggroup.com. Conferences, piles of flyers, getting stuck in endless email lists and never-ending calls. There's an easier way to sort through and identify the best school fundraisers. School Spirit Vending proudly presents the Top 10 School Fundraising Ideas of 2017. It's a guide of the top fundraising companies hand-picked from the best podcast. As an added bonus, this guide lists five resource companies that would add tremendous value to your community, school, and students. The best part is that School Spirit Vending is giving the guide away completely free. Are you ready to simplify the search? Download the free guide at schoolzonepodcast.com.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. And the other part I want to ask you about is it sounds like by being outside of the situation, you're able to come up with more creative solutions. Does that sound right?
And Well, I think first of all, when you're in this situation, you know, it's much more, in many ways, it's much more personal. You know, the real personalities at play and real relationships. And so sometimes it's hard to see beyond because you get stuck in how people view you or how people talk to you or these kinds of things. Or your political posturing and how you're ingratiating yourself with whoever the powers may be. Whereas when you're removed from that, you're really able to look at it more clearly. You know, you're not, your personality is not, or your character is not on the line in the same type of way. So I think that that's one aspect of it. But for me, it's been as much a fact that when I stepped away, I was just more easily and more clearly able to see, you know, what I did right, but also a lot of what I did wrong. And, you know, I may have owned up to it in various ways while I was on the job, but I still felt like, you know, I was trying to preserve a certain degree of success, you know, trying to preserve a certain degree of, not that I didn't have success, but what I mean is I was trying to frame it because I felt like that framing was really critical for my success and the benefits of the school, et cetera. But once I stepped away, I was able to say, you know, this is really what I should have done with regards to finding a mentor and working with that person consistently, creating opportunities for delegation, building more relationships, managing change more effectively and more deliberately, and these kinds of things, and setting proper expectations with the board and the right type of assessment tool so that we're all on the same page of what we consider to be important and how we're going to measure for it, and on and on and on. And so that reflection, I now do quite a bit of writing. I write for Smart Brief, I write for Huffington Post and for others. And while most of my focus is on leadership, I do draw very much from my personal experience, which was all in school leadership. And as a result, I'm able to at least create a, not just sort of a punch list of steps to take, but putting it with a real character, you know, in a real narrative in a way that I think people can better relate to and ultimately appreciate.
You know, and speaking of appreciation, I think they're going to appreciate the new book that's coming out, Becoming the New Boss. And if I heard you correctly in our pre-chat, again, this was a resource that you wish you had. And I know that's available. It's going to be linked up for our listeners at becomingthenewboss.com. But can you tell us a little bit about the new book?
Yes. So this is a book that I'm very excited about. I've written before, like I said, very extensively, but I've never put together a project quite like this, about 55,000 words, 46 chapters. They're not long chapters. They're actually intended to be short, sweet, and digestible so that folks can get the concept and then move forward. But the book is divided into a number of sections, which really are intended to walk new leaders. And it's not specifically school leaders, but again, I think it would have particular resonance with the school leadership community because of the fact that my personal examples are almost exclusively based on, you know, what I did or did not do well in my school leadership role. And so I'm trying to help individuals who are like me coming into a new position, whether they're literally a rookie, somebody who had been a teacher in a classroom and got promoted into their first administrative position, or perhaps from mid-level administration to the head of school, or some other type of transition, even from principal in school X to principal in school Y. You know, what are the things you want to be thinking about and considering? Everything from getting to understand what type of organization you're going into and trying to determine or ascertain the quality of fit to, and associated with that, establishing a proper set of, let's call it, expectations, job description, I mentioned before, assessment, all of those elements to ensure that you know exactly what you're getting into, what you're signing up for, and they know the same. And then working the process through. We talked about change management. That's a whole section within the book. Being a good listener, developing those first, you know, those early relationships, utilizing the first 90 or 100 days to your advantage. There are also some sections. The first section actually has to do with what leadership really is. So before I get into the nuts and bolts of moving into leadership, I want folks to understand what leadership is, how it differs from management, what the opportunities of leadership are. And then on the end, or on the back end, I should say, of the book, we focus on elements of sustainability. So things like work-life balance and values and really giving leaders a shot in the arm that this is critical work. And it's not easy. And nobody ever said it's going to be easy. But at the same time, it's worth it. And, you know, there's an interesting, I don't remember the quote by heart, but I know that it's in my book. And I think about it here and there by Winston Churchill. And basically to the effect of that, you know, criticism is part of the job. And if you don't hear from folks when you do things, in effect, it's as if, you know, whatever you did was really not important to them. So I think one of the things leaders need to understand is that they're going to be criticized, and they're going to be criticized often as part of what they're signing up for. But at the same time, that criticism comes from the fact that what they do every day and who they are is significant. And as a result of that, it's like a double-edged sword. On the one hand, You know, you want that significance. You want that impact. That's why you're there, right? It's a nicer paycheck, certainly, than if you're, you know, in the rank and file. But that's not the real motivator, I don't think, for most people to become school leaders. I think they want to magnify and maximize their impact. You know, they want to take their passion for education and bring it to the next level. They don't feel they can do that from their own individual classroom. So they take on that position, and then they're overwhelmed by the challenges, by the demands on their time, and frankly, by the criticism and by the, you know, the difficulties that arise. And so it's important, I think, to keep in perspective that while nobody likes criticism, it's how you handle it, both in terms of listening to it, distilling the kernels of truth that exist within it, taking steps by which to validate the speaker and take steps to improve the situation, let everybody know that you're learning, you're growing. It's not a process where you're not open to change. But at the same time, that you can sort of take yourself away from it and say, they're not criticizing me as the person. They're criticizing what they feel is the lack of perfection or the ideal for their child or for their school community. And as a result, and you just happen to be the person who's the lightning rod for that because you are the leader, the person who everybody identifies with the school. So I think that when leaders see sort of like the soup to nuts that the book presents, giving them an overview, acknowledging many of their fears and concerns, and yet at the same time trying to provide them with concrete strategies that they could utilize in bulleted form that makes it easy to see and easy to incorporate, that I think helps people, you know, to process, to know that they're not alone. Because it can be. It's a very lonely position sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to digress too much, but I remember when I was in my first master's program, I read a book that claimed, for all intents and purposes, that teaching was the loneliest position in the world, or certainly of the loneliest. And there's truth to that, because you're interacting with kids all day, and that's not the same as interacting with peers. And not every teacher really gets the opportunity to have meaningful conversations with adults that they can relate to, etc. But I feel that the school leader is that much more vulnerable to loneliness, because who can they turn to, you know, in times of difficulty? They can't really turn to the board. They don't want to expose themselves and their weaknesses. They don't feel perhaps that they could talk to their other administrators if those are their direct reports. They certainly can't talk to teachers or people of the community. So who can they talk to? You know, that kind of thing. So that they need to know that you should be reaching out to other people. You're not alone, but you do have to proactively seek that conversation sometimes. And you need to find ways, whether it's going to conferences or building small group conversations or whatever it might be, you find a network of people that you can grow with. And you also find mentors that you can lean on who are going to provide that kind of support and encouragement. And so through use of quotes and leadership research and facts and best practices and also personal anecdotes, I try to take all of that information and present it to the reader in a way that hopefully they will find to be meaningful and help them do what they do best.
I think they will. And, you know, listeners, I highly, highly encourage you to check out Becoming the New Boss. And you've probably been listening to the show for quite a while, so you know that all these great resources that Natalie has been sharing, like this new book, will be linked up for you in the show notes. You know, I started this podcast because I wanted to learn from great leaders like yourself. And in a very selfish way, this show is for me. I offer it on, you know, everywhere, my website, iTunes, Stitcher, Google, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's all free. And so people benefit from the conversation. But I just want to say, you know, thank you so much, because like even that last little bit about criticism, I needed to hear that. I'm finishing up currently, as we're recording in May, I'll finish up my first year as principal at a middle school in Houston. And then by the time this releases in July, I'll be packing my bags on my way to Belgium with, you know, my new wife, and she accepted a academic position over there in Europe.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks. But the criticism, yeah. Naftali is tough, you know, and I needed to hear that part of that is because you were shifting paradigms and molding people's perspectives. You were doing work that matters.
Yeah, that's really what it is.
Yeah, and the listeners, like, you all need to hear that too, because you're probably doing important work. And there's your fan club, and then there's your haters as well. But that's because you're doing something that's real, and it's meaningful, and it's important. You touched on loneliness, and yeah, teachers, sure, they could be isolated. They need to collaborate. But that's why I started, you know, masterminds for school leaders, at the time of recording, and they're closed. Maybe when they're this show's released, they'll be open again. But that's a solution for that. It's a safe place, a network where you can connect with others and grow with others and really get your professional needs met. It's just a beautiful thing, but I'm not going to talk too much about that. That's more about me than you. But I do want to ask you this, I think in a final closing question before kind of just hitting some rapid fire stuff, but work-life balance. I used to ask guests, Naftali, like, what do you think about it? I took the question out because, to be quite honest, like all the answers were not challenging or engaging to me. So I didn't think they would be to the listeners. And a lot of people just said, like, throw it out. Like, it's just not even a reality. And then I've started, I guess, leaning towards this idea that, okay, well, if work-life balance isn't able to happen, it's like getting very clear with, let's say, your partner and your family in terms of expectations, so that when you're at work, you're at work, and when you're home and fully present. So I like that idea of being present. But you piqued my interest. You said you addressed it in the book. So I'm just curious, where do you stand on the work-life balance discussion?
Yeah, so it does sadden me to hear. It doesn't surprise me, but it definitely saddens me to hear the idea that many folks, I guess, were sharing that they don't feel that it's possible. I don't agree. I do think that work is more consuming than ever, and I do think that, like you talked about, being present is more important than ever. I remember hearing a story told by an educator that I respect, who at one point in time was trying to pitch an educational program to different principals in a particular community. And he goes to school number one, and the principal gives him an hour plus of his time, but he's constantly interrupted by secretaries, phone calls, you name it. And the other school he goes, and he's there for 5 minutes. He had to wait for a while till he got in. But when he finally sat down to have that conversation, there were no interruptions. All eyes were fixed on him, and they had their conversation, and it was very practical, goal-oriented, and things got done. And that person told us in that particular session that he felt more heard and more validated, even though he was given much less time by that second principal, because of the fact that he was present for the conversation. So being present is critical. You know, with our cell phones, smartphones, and other devices, it's really easy to get distracted, even in personal time. People think that they can access you no matter what. And so I think it is important. It's not easy, especially for new leaders, to impose, you know, their values on others. But I think that it's reasonable to say, I need to be able to have personal time. I need to be able to be disconnected at certain areas and only reached for emergency. To create that expectation up front, I think is really important, because I think that if you do, then you actually have a chance at sustaining it. And if you don't, it's much harder to go ahead and implement at a later point in time. In addition to that, I think that we all have to realize that we're not machines. And, you know, there's a lot of turnover in school leadership, tremendous amount of churn. I've written about it. It's certainly something that anyone could easily find online. You see it in the public sector. When I say public sector, I mean the public school community, as well as within the independent school world, that principals are not lasting for extended periods of time, perhaps as they may have once done. And the impact of change at the top of a school is tremendous. And I think one of the reasons as to why principals are struggling so much, besides for not necessarily having the tools or the mindset necessary to be a leader in a school without that proper training, is the fact that it can be so overwhelming and so stressful that it just burns people out. And so that's why I think that having balance, being able to do things outside of your professional responsibility, to pursue your interests and your passions, to make sure that you find time for exercise, for other things that brings you physical stimulation and ultimately physical fitness. All of these things are important. You know, you need to bring your A game to work every day, and you can't do it if you're not, as Stephen Covey once said, if you're not sharpening your own saw and making sure that you're providing that type of internal juice that you can then bring to everybody else. You know, their inspiration, their motivation is going to start with the school leader. And so the school leader really needs to be able to optimize. So I'm not saying it's easy. And I'm not saying it's always possible. You can always just shut things down and kind of move into your own personal space. But the more that you are mindful of that as a prerequisite, not because you're trying to hide from anything, but just because you want to do your job the very best you can. And of course, maintain all the relationships that are going to sustain well beyond whatever professional position you find yourself in today, whether that's a spouse, children, etc. You know, you need to think long term. And I think that if a person does have that long term mindset and sees the end game and how this can all play out, they'll find it much easier to focus on and then pursue the things that provide that balance for them.
Well, now, Tyler, let's do a couple just rapid fire, you know, really just three questions, and then we'll wrap it up here. But
sure.
Just curious, what do you do for fun?
I love to write, actually. That might not sound like fun, but actually
it does,
the other
it
thing.
Does. I love it too.
Yeah, yeah, I do. But that's me, my introvert again. The other thing I love to do that I get made fun of a lot, at least within my own family, is I love to plant and maintain a garden. I find it to be very therapeutic. And I was just reminded of it because the other day I was locked out of one of my accounts, and it brought up, you know, what is one of these security questions. And the question was, what is your favorite warm weather activity? And I'm looking at the list. I said, I must have chosen gardening. And in fact, that one worked.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't water skiing. It wasn't, you know, some high. A high octane, exciting thing. It was just me in the garden,
diving.
Plucking the weeds and putting in my bulbs and, you know, getting my garden going. So I do enjoy that.
That's fantastic.
And sometimes I think my family just feels it's a little obsessive, but I try to maintain that.
There you go.
Yeah.
If you could be automatically good at something, what would it be?
I wish I was a better conversationalist. You know, I think that when I have a conversation such as the one we're having right now, like-minded people where you know that you have a common interest, it's relatively easy for me to talk and to share. But I find that, you know, going into open spaces and having to engage with people that I've never met before and try to engage with them in something more than a superficial, hello, what's your name, that could be a little bit more difficult. And so I wish I was a little bit more felt a little bit more natural in those types of settings because I feel like it would open up even more opportunities for me.
Quick aside, I'm running this 6-week group coaching of how to get more done in 3 months than most people do in a year.
Uh-huh.
And we started talking today just about life plans and stuff. And I was reviewing one I wrote a little over a year ago. And it's amazing like how far I've come in terms of, I said I'm a recovering introvert and that I've switched more to extrovert. But, you know, reading How to Win Friends and Influence People, that and starting a podcast, now I can talk to people.
Uh-huh.
And I think the two reasons would be, one, just putting yourself in those positions, right, where you kind of have to grow that muscle.
Yep.
But the other thing is just ask great questions, you know.
Yeah.
And it takes the pressure off of having to be entertaining or telling great stories, which you do. But like you said, we're like-minded. But asking those great questions and allowing people to be a hero, right, and giving them the space to talk has really helped me meet a lot of interesting people.
Sure.
And push me out of my introvert zone.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't at any point mean to imply that I don't appreciate my introverted nature.
For sure.
For those who have not watched the TED Talk by Susan Cain,
so
I would
good.
Encourage you to do so because, you know, she really makes a compelling case for the benefits of introversion as well as educators' needs to honor and respect, you know, what introverts bring to the table. That said, I do know that having an extroverted element at least really opens up doors because people connect with people. You know, yes, I can share ideas with my blog and with my articles, and that's all wonderful and good. But, you know, people want to be able to connect with others that they feel that they can relate to, et cetera. And I feel that to the degree that I'm not as good in that area as I should be, ultimately that's going to diminish my ability to perhaps reach as many people as I would like to reach. So that would be an area I'd like to work on.
Gotcha. Well, thank you for sharing that with the listeners. And the last question, what message would you put on all school marquees across the globe if you could do so for one day?
That's a great question. You know, in Jewish tradition, there is actually, you know, the listeners may find this interesting, but in the entire Old Testament, that includes more than just the 5 books of Moses, there is only one verse that speaks to education. It was written by King Solomon. And the verse says, educate the child according to his way so that when he grows older, he will not deviate from it. And I think that that captures, you know, a lot of really the core elements of what I think about when it comes to education. Number one, that we have to be able to differentiate. I know it's hard and to be able to, you know, think about the unique needs of each child. And those are not just academic needs, as we know, they're emotional needs and other things as well, but also to maintain a passion or to engender a passion for learning that is so deeply ingrained that even as we get older, and even as we've moved into our professional careers and sort of set up shop with our family and everything else, that we should never view ourselves as being maxed out in terms of our education. We should always be yearning for and seeking opportunity to learn more. And I think that if maybe that verse or something similar to it would be a message, I'm not saying it doesn't exist already, but if that could be a message that could have even greater resonance within schools all throughout the world, I think that we would start to see our students differently, ourselves differently, and it would create that much more appreciation for the incredible work that educators do every day.
Well, Naftali, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, so I mean, we certainly have talked about quite a bit, and I think that to me, the key about being an effective educator, whether that means a classroom teacher, an administrator, or anyone else within the educational universe, is to keep learning, to recognize that the world is just the default is change, especially in education. We see more and more of that, and so I feel that if we maintain this concept of lifelong learners, we're willing to go beyond ourselves to learn new things, to engage with new people. To become a little bit vulnerable when necessary in order to own up not only to things we might not have done right, but also to try new things that might involve a little bit of risk. I think that's the kind of behavior that ultimately produces great results. And that's really what our students need and deserve. They deserve us doing our best, not resting on past laurels, but allowing us to, by expecting, if you will, that we're going to be, you know, top of the line in everything that we do. And as far as reaching me, you can visit either one of my two websites, becomingthenewboss.com or impactfulcoaching.com. Impactful Coaching is my core website where you can learn more about my coaching, consulting, and professional development / speaking services. Becomingthenewboss.com focuses specifically on the book and provides video and other insights about the book, why it was written, my favorite chapters, and all that good stuff. And so I'd love to engage with the listeners further. You can find me on Twitter at impactfulcoach.com. I'm sorry, not .com, at impactfulcoach. And I hope that this is just the beginning of opportunity to share ideas and hopefully to learn and grow with one another.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I would love to have you back. Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Naftali. You better start today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Naftali in the search bar. The show notes page will pop up. You'll get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Naftali, thank you again for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
Better Leaders, just a few more things before you take off. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show. This helps gives the show some social proof, aka iTunes juice, and encourages new people to listen to the show. If you are a social media junkie, share your biggest takeaway from the show, and feel free to tag me on Twitter or Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer. Take the letters, switch them around, and create something interesting and new. That's how I got it. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Do you want to get a short email from me every Sunday where I share the best resources I have come across, links to interesting articles, books, blogs, and podcasts that have challenged my thinking, and a quote that's inspired me and will inspire you as well? If you'd like access to this resource, head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and join the newsletter at the top of the page. Over 1,000 school leaders subscribe, and I think you'll benefit from it too. In the newsletter, I also share when a new blog or podcast comes out, as well as different opportunities to work with me. Thanks again for listening to the show.